played. There was no question how many Mishnayot have you learned, how many Masechtos of Gemara have you learned, you know, have you, etc., etc., etc. So my friends and I, we all thought it was very funny that I had failed in American Judaism, although I thought I was more successful in Judaism. I don't love the term movements. I'm very ambivalent about the whole thing. Partially, I grew up in the conservative movement. One of the reasons I fled is because they talk about the movement all the time as opposed to Torah and Mitzvot. It really used to drive me batty. Movement. What does that mean? we're going to talk about in a few minutes, and as I said, I'll give you a little time to ruminate over some makarot, no one we're going to look at ever self-identified as modern Orthodox in any way. They might have self-identified as people who kept Torah and Mitzvot, who thought Torah was important, who thought learning was important if there's not enough ball photocopy afterwards, etc. So it's always like a funny thing to talk about modern Orthodox movement or what does that mean. I want to spend 10 minutes now talking a little about the history of how we got to where we got to. More than you didn't do with history, right?
No.
I want to spend 10 minutes, a little bit about history, modernity and history. Then we'll take a few minutes to read those texts, and then we'll relate to Rav Hirsch, Rav Cook, and the Rav. The first time I gave a lecture on this, these three figures as kind of pillars of ideas in Judaism was actually to a group of Reform students who were here as a Reform high school program. And I was invited by a whole cluster of Reform programs to speak at the HUC here. It was really a lot of fun. And I start out by learning, I mentioned this in the Gemara share, I start out by learning Yigdal with them. Because most of them, Yigdal resonated to some degree. If they're Reform students that came to Israel, they'd probably go to synagogue sometimes. And Yigdal is, you know, it's fun. You sing it. Things you sing are fun. And they sang it and had experience with it. And they were a little shocked when I actually went through a translation of Yigdal with them and talked about issues of Emunah. The Daf Makor I gave you is going to start out with, and again, I've already did a lot of this, so you don't have to spend so much time on it. But starts out with a basic principle: Moshe Bel Torah Masinai, Misrali Yoshua, Yeshua's Kenim, Uskenim Levim, Levim Masrul Anshei Kesagdola. Many here people know that by heart. Moshe Kibel Torah Masinai, a basic principle, the beginning of Masechet Avot, Mishnayot, central pillar of Rabbinic Judaism is the idea Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah, and the Torah that we have is continuation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to man. The covenantal kind of meeting of man and God. And everybody who considers themselves within a rubric of Torah meets vote, if you're Satmar, the Satmar Rebbe's here, I don't know if you guys have noticed, my daughter got caught up in traffic over it, and then there's all the tension. How can we let the Satmar Rebbe in? He's anti-Zionist. They don't let in the liberal anti-Zionists. And you read all those things in the paper and all those fun things. And it's funny that some of my friends who were very upset about not letting in the, you know, like people BDS people and Code Pink people and whatever, are very upset. You know, they're very upset that we didn't let them in, and very upset that we did let the Satmar Rebbe in. So I'm a little confused on, you know, everybody's confused, I guess. There's a little confusion in life. Let me ask you a question. If you take a course in history, I know I took a million courses in history. There was one point in time where I thought I was going to become a professor of history, and I didn't. That didn't happen. But sometimes when you do these things, you kind of like want to live your childhood over again. So I did abandon my PhD, but I spent a lot of time in courses on history, and we survey courses in history. The first question they ask you is, how do you define a period? If I take a course in medieval Jewish history or medieval history, well, what are the Middle Ages? And why did I call it Middle Ages? Is that a biased term to begin with? Blah, blah, blah. All those types of questions. Modernity for Judaism and Jewish history is different than, I would say, a history course you would take in general history. They define things differently, define the Middle Ages differently. You know, by the way, Middle Ages, medieval, where that comes from? Who invented that term? Anybody? Where it comes from? Think about it. Middle Ages, what does it indicate? It's a middle, right? Because what does it mean? There was something good before, and there was something good after, and now there's something in the middle we got to deal with, right? It was invented by Protestants as a jab, the Dark Ages, to criticize Catholicism, right? If you go to in Sephardic history and in the Islamic world, it's a whole different way you look at history, and it's ironic because when you take a Jewish history course, no one disparages the Middle Ages, right? It's the Rishonim, the golden age of Spain, and highlights Rashi and Rambam and Ramban, right? All these great thinkers, and no matter even Maimonides and however you want to cut it up, right? They always look at the Middle Ages as something of great significance, opposed to the Protestants who are like, the Catholics, the Catholics are blah, and we Protestants have made it. So if I were to ask you about modernity, though. What, like, is the beginning of the modern age for Judaism? Not necessarily, and they might overlap with the world at large, right, with ideas in the world at large, but what is that, what is the beginning of modernity for Judaism? Yeah?
I think in Napoleon Bonaparte's speech where you can be a French Jew, so meaning you can, in the Enlightenment and the Emancipation, people started believing you can be modern. You can be part of our nation.
Okay, so the French Revolution and just after the wake of the French Revolution. That could be. Some people might say that modernity started there with Voltaire describing, the nature of humankind, although he was a big anti-Semite, but he also was partially also attacking Catholicism. That could be. By the way, there's some Zionist historians who say 1948, when we actually became, back on the world stage and had power. Jews were disempowered before and empowered after 48. But we could go back to there. There was a great struggle, as you know. France and the United States of America were the first countries to emancipate the Jews. What does emancipation mean? It wasn't even emancipate the Jews.
Give them equal social rights.
Treat them as citizens, right? If you know, in Germany, for instance, the same time period, Moses Mendelssohn was the first Jew who was allowed to live. He didn't, but he was allowed. He was invited to live in Berlin. Jews were not allowed to live in cities, right? You had to live in a town, but they were not sophisticated enough. They didn't want to contaminate the city by allowing Jews to live in the cities. So it could be France and the United States said, for different reasons, and eventually England, and then it started to spread. In Germany, there was a prolonged emancipation period. They weren't sure if Jews were human or not, right? In France also, that was one of the things that pushed. Voltaire said they're not human, right? They can never be citizens of France because they're not really regular human beings. That was the beginning of modern anti-Semitism. It's ironic. With modernity, all the great things of modernity, freedom, blah, blah, also came that. There's a famous debate supposedly between the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Bala Tanya, and some other Hasidic Rebbes, between when the French and the Russians were at war, who to root for. Anyone know this? It's a great story. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe rooted for whom?
I think it was the
Russians. And some of the other Hasidic Rabbis, I heard the name of Berdichev, but he was dead already. But some of the other Hasidic Rabbis were supporting France. Why do you support France?
Freedom!
They would give the Jews freedom! Why do you think the Lubavitcher Rebbe supported the Russians? Because freedom is very dangerous. It will destroy the soul of the Jewish people. Right? Intermarriage, forgetting Jewish tradition, it will be destructive. So he thought it was better, the Jews did better under oppression than they would under freedom. There's a lot to discuss about that as a notion. I'm not advocating that we go back to the Pale of Settlement in Russia, but there's what to talk about. Okay, what about earlier? Can we think about anything might be earlier? Yeah.
Enough is earlier, the start of the Reform Movement.
So I wouldn't say, by the way, I wouldn't say Napoleon. I would probably say Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was the first Jew who started thinking about being a Jew at home and a citizen in the streets to convince the Germans that, yes, indeed, we Jews are human. We can live like everybody else. Right? Yeah. What?
Is the start of the Reform Movement after that?
Yeah, well, Mendelssohn kind of started it all. Okay. Right? Mendelssohn kind of to a degree, but there are underpinnings before. Yeah. Well, so Haskalah is going to be, Mendelssohn's part of that whole thing. We go a little bit back before then. Some people want to say that Shabtai Tzvi was the beginning of modernity for Jews. because Shabtai Tzvi, according to some historians, who was Shabtai Tzvi?
He's the supposed Messiah.
So this false Messiah. Now there's a question, how many Jews followed him? There's a book called The Memoir of Glückel of Hameln. Anyone ever heard of The Memoir of Glückel of Hameln? You heard of it? It's very cool. I highly recommend you read it. Right? I read it on a train from Boston to New York on a date. Didn't work out. We didn't get married, but at least I got to read the book. So that was, you know, worthwhile. So The Memoir of Glückel is stupendous because it's a memoir of a Jewish woman, which we have very few of, around 1700, describing her life. So it's a picture of German Jewish life, a memoir of German Jewish life from a woman's perspective, and giving us this thing. There are all kinds, if you take an academic course, it's like, did her son adulterate it? Did he change things? Whatever, but you could read it. The same thing, you know, they say about Anne Frank's diary, etc. You know, you get all those academic debates. But Shabtai Tzvi, she and Glückel of Hameln, she mentions how she remembers her uncle as a kid. She remembers her uncle had his bags packed and was ready to go, sold his house, had his suitcases packed, and was ready to go to the Holy Land because the Messiah was here. Right? So how far it spread is questionable. We know there are many rabbis who followed Shabtai Tzvi. How many? We don't know. But after it was false and he converted to Islam, right? He converted to Islam. So that might have been like a crack in Jews who were following rabbinic leadership. Might have said, hey, if our rabbis can make a mistake about that, what else are they making a mistake about? That's a possibility. And all of a sudden people started reanalyzing what does it mean to be Jewish. Go back a little further, or around the same time actually, is some people suggest Spinoza. So Spinoza, not as much as philosophy, that was significant, but Spinoza socially had a really interesting thing. In the Middle Ages, 1300, in the year 1300, if you were living in Ashkenaz and you didn't like listen to the rabbis, going, you know, in the wake of Rabbeinu Tam, which is 150 years earlier, but you're listening to rabbis. You know, you decided you didn't want to keep kosher anymore. So you went hunting and you trapped, I don't know, what you would trap in the Rhineland, a beaver or something. And, you know, that's, you know, I'm thinking of like, you know, what's his name from America? But you trapped a beaver or something. You decided to cook it up and eat it. And they're like, oh my gosh, you ate non-kosher food. So they might excommunicate you. You know what happened in the year 1300 if you were in Spire? And Spire, and you were excommunicated, you had three choices. You know what those choices were? Convert. You could convert to Christianity. Die. You could what?
Die.
That's the last one. Die. You could repent. And repenting wasn't necessarily so easy to get the community to forgive you, or you could die. That was basically it. The Christians wouldn't deal with you. And by the way, I'm dealing primarily with Europe. I'm not dealing with Sephardic lands so much, right? I'm dealing with all the way to maybe to Spain, although they didn't have excommunication in the same way Ashkenaz did, but I'm not dealing with Edom, Israq, and North Africa because this has nothing to do with them, right? They did not have, we'll talk about Orthodoxy, whatever, but it had nothing to do with them. They were just Jews. I like it a lot better, to be honest with you, but we can talk about that also in another context. So Spinoza was the first person living in Amsterdam. He got up and said, you know what? Excommunicate me. I'll go live with the Christians. And you know what was interesting? They didn't kill him. He didn't convert. He just hung out, kept making eyeglasses and writing very complicated pantheistic theology. And everybody was cool with it. Right? So it could be that was the first person who kind of sparked in Central Europe that, you know what? Maybe there's a way to live kind of as a Jew, not as a Christian, kind of living in that world. We go even further back, and probably one of the most devastating things, which for us is sometimes pales in our reality because the Shoah is so big, right? The Spanish expulsion. We don't always understand the wave of impact, the events I mentioned, that I won't get into it now, from 1391, but in 1492, 100 years later, well, in 1492, when the Jews were kicked out of Spain, it was the largest Jewish community under a single communal banner, the Jews of Spain. And they were lost. Sometimes we don't understand what happened, the gravity of the situation. Imagine it was just like the Shoah. All of a sudden they went to community and said, here's the date, pack your bags, leave. And you like take nothing with you, right? Part of the goal, seemingly, possibly, was to pay for the reconquest of Spain. The court needed money, and therefore they took the money from the Jews. It was always good to do that. The Spanish were stupid, though, like the Brits. The Brits weren't very smart either. They kicked the Jews out. What was it, like 1240, whatever it was? They kicked them out, and that was it. Did it one time. The Spanish followed the Brits, and they didn't do it right either. The ones who got it right were the French. They kicked them out, invite them back, kicked them out, invite them back. They kept kicking us out, right? Because they know, come back, make some money, we'll take your money, leave, right? Kick the Jews out, steal all our money, and then we come back and, you know, we make money again. Seemingly, we have developed a cultural adaptation ability to do that, and we survived. So it's not clear, but something cracked. In the Middle Ages, more or less, Jewish communities were to a large degree holistic. They were homogeneous. You had leadership, whatever the different models were in different countries, you had leadership, you followed those leaders, right? As time progressed, either because of these various tumultuous events, things started to crack. If we get our age of emancipation, we went backwards, now going forwards again. Germany became the seat of reform, and people often misunderstand this unfairly. The Reform movement started not with an ideal of destroying Judaism. That's often like, you know, the Haredi books are like, oh, they drive us through. It's not what happened. What happened was is that Jews were living in Germany, and they're like, well, gee, I can do a lot better if I become Lutheran. Why am I doing this? By the way, hundreds of years earlier, Yehuda Halevi praises a Jewish community in Spain for not converting, although many did later on. He praises them and says, wow, just by staying a Jew is such a colossal thing. Right, today, people, you know, I just saw an article, I'm no longer wearing Magen David out in New York. I just can't fathom it, right? You know, one of our alumni, I don't see who it was, last year I saw him on a plane, we were both coming to Israel, I was coming back, one of my ridiculous trips, begging for money, and I was coming back, and he was there, and he's going to help me raise money, but we're not going together, he's working for whatever, and I saw him, and he was flying business class, he was a little embarrassed, but his company was doing that, and he said, I really have to, Rabbi, I said, that's fine me, you know, gig is an ape. He says, you hear what happened? I said, no, he got beat up in Manhattan, he was wearing a kippah, and some guy, not in the news, not anything, it's unfathomable. Right? He was very shook up. He still shook up to this day. This was a year ago. He went to the police, the whole thing. They had the video, right? You know, in the middle of Manhattan. He said, but it wasn't in the news. There were ones in Brooklyn. There were several ones in Brooklyn that were in the news. It was one of our alumni, one of our stellar alumni, and very shook up. Okay. So getting back to future, going back, in Germany, Jews wanted to finally take part in the world. The world was moving forward. The concept of the individual was starting to kick up as opposed to the community. Communities, therefore, were breaking apart. France, United States, England, all these places were allowing the Jews to become citizens. People in Germany wanted to be citizens. The easy ticket to become a citizen is to convert out. So some Jewish leaders said, hey, wait a minute. We're going to lose Jewish people. Let's save them. How? Let's make Judaism popular again. How? By showing these people that there's something worthwhile in Judaism. The Jews don't leave because it's great. And showing the Germans, the Jews became citizens as well, even if they're religious, because it's great, it's nice. So therefore, the early Reform were trying to polish up Judaism, find the keys, what they felt were the kernel of Judaism, which was the prophets and morality and all these notions. And in fact, there's an invitation to a synagogue in Berlin. It's great. Invitation to a synagogue in Berlin. In one of the early Reform synagogues, to this taking out of the Torah service in full musical accompaniment. I don't have the invitation. I had it in class and whatever. I couldn't find it again online. It must be online somewhere. What's fascinating about this is not that there's musical Kriyas Torah, you know, taking the Torah out. It's on Thursday. Why do you think they invited Jews to come, they invited priests to come, whatever, ministers, Lutheran ministers to come. Why do you think they had it on Thursday? When's the big Kriyas HaTorah's win?
Saturday.
Shabbat! So why did they have it on Thursday?
People would be like taking videos and stuff.
Because music is Asur on Shabbat. Right? So early Reform, we're trying to figure out, various rabbis, how far we can push this. Not talking America yet. America will have a whole different scene. How far we can push this. That's what happened. There was some reaction to that, which was the nascent, which will become the nascent conservative movement in America. I don't have time to talk about that now, really, but just in a nutshell, there were some people who wanted to maintain tradition but were very interested in the academic wave that was sweeping Europe, which was looking at cultures in a whole new way. That's probably the Enlightenment. And they were jumping on the Enlightenment idea but not abandoning tradition. And that was the people who are often labeled the Wissenschaft des Judentums people, a whole series of academics, Gratz and whatever other people, and they went that direction. In wake of that, we're then going to get to your sense of Hirsch rejecting reform. Well, there still is. There's an organization called the Orthodox Forum. The Orthodox Forum meets once a year. They have a call for papers. People submit papers on a topic. You know, often the topics seem to like overlap a lot. So they have topics like Judaism and medical ethics issues, or Torah and the secular world, or Torah and the other, or Torah and those things which are not Torah. like a bunch of the volumes seem to be very similar. They strive to have it. They did have one on Torah and sexual ethics, but the people who did that had to beg for the Orthodox Forum to actually do that. The Orthodox Forum, one time, so they do is they have a bunch of people who are invited, and they have a call for papers. People submit papers on the topic. The people present the papers like any academic conference, and at the end they publish the papers in a book a couple years later. We have a bunch of the volumes. I'm sure you've seen them in there. So one of the years, the call for papers was on Torah, was on the following question. Is it justifiable? Is it, you know, a logical approach to Judaism, to Torah, to take the attitude of Rosenzer Phil Hirsch's attitude towards Torah im Derech Eretz, on the one hand, take Rav Kook's attitude towards Zionism on the second hand, and the Rav's attitude towards secular philosophy on the third hand, and make out of this kind of a worldview, not taking one thinker per se, but creating a worldview out of that. Rav Lichtenstein was one of the respondents, and I was struck by the beginning of his response, is he was a little disturbed that, and this is telling as a Litvak, he was a little disturbed that they included Rav Hirsch in the same category with Rav Kook and Rabbi Soloveitchik. Can you guess why that would be? I was a little shocked when I read it. And I've seen he said this a few times. I think Rav Lichtenstein was not a huge fan of Rav Hirsch's methodology. He might appreciate him, but was not a huge fan of his methodology, and criticized him in several places. But can you guess why?
It's too modern.
Well, too modern for a reason, though. He complained that both Rav Kook and the Rav were great Talmudists. They're great halachists. Rav Hirsch really spent a very brief time in yeshiva, a year and a half or something like that. He got to speak like a year and a half, and that was it. When he was like 20 or 21, became a pulpit rabbi, was involved in communal work. He was incredibly prolific. He clearly was a genius and a half. If you open up his commentary on Vayikra, forget the rest of the commentary on Chumash, but just look at the commentary on Vayikra, it's astounding his knowledge of Torah Shebaal Peh and Kachim, especially for someone who really had very little exposure to traditional, hardcore traditional learning. He was a German Jew of a certain bent. I remember speaking to Rabbi Rav Avia, Tabori's father, who gave two examples of people who it just seemed that they picked up learning on the fly. One was Rav Hirsch, and one was the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, and how big, you know, incredible geniuses they were in learning, even though both of them had their exposure was limited and they had been involved in many other things. Rav Hirsch came with was clearly impacted. I have a friend who actually from Princeton wrote a book called When Did Judaism Become a Religion? Anyone seen this book by Laura Batnitsky? It's a fun book. It's really a course in modern Jewish history. I highly recommend it. She has lengthy bibliographies at the end of each chapter, so you can, like, you know, find other academic works on the topic. She makes the following suggestion. She suggests that Moshe Mendelssohn, although in many Orthodox circles he's really demonized, he himself was a Shomer Mitzvot Jew who was interested in learning and wrote a commentary on Chumash in German, etc. And then Mendelssohn kind of set up a new trajectory in thought. And looking at Judaism, again, like Mendelssohn's idea that you could be a Jew in your house and a German in the street, there's no reason you should make any difference between Jews and Germans, basically making Judaism into a religious aspect. And Rav Lichtenstein felt that Rav Hirsch was highly influenced by German thought as opposed to intrinsic Jewish thought, and really took a lot of German thought and applied it to Torah. He gave an example of someone else who did that, who he was a bigger fan of. Who else took outside thought, not intrinsically Jewish thought, and really applied it to Jewish texts? The Rambam. The Rambam. The Rambam is a fascinating example. He didn't. He didn't exactly. The Rav, as opposed to Lichtenstein, supposing in Rabbi Soloveitchik's Gemarashir, he would never quote anything that wasn't Torah. He would never quote, as a proof example, some poem by somebody. He would never quote some literature, nothing. In Gemarashir was Gemarashir, and it was the same thing you would have gotten at YU in, 1960 in Washington Heights as you would get in Lithuania, in Vilna in 1850. Made no difference. He kept the Gemara Shir pristine. Rav Lichtenstein did not. He would quote other things in Shir, but that was a deviation from the Rav. But when you read Rav Hirsch, you clearly see he's highly influenced by those things. But I want to glance at this passage, which becomes, for Rav Hirsch, emblematic. The passage, this is one passage, but it's kind of like try to search around for something that would do that. What's the topic? What's the topic of the Hirsch passage? Pirkei Avot. Does anyone know that passage, Pirkei Avot, on top of their heads? Yefet, Talmud Torah, Im Derech Eretz, right? Kishnei Hamshachot Avon. It's good to both learn and have Derech Eretz. What was Derech Eretz when you're like Ganenet, when your like kindergarten teacher yelled, scolded you? Or your what?
Respect.
Derech Eretz. What does the word Derech Eretz literally mean?
Way of the land.
Derech Eretz is used in rabbinic literature, but it's used before that in Tanakh. Derech Eretz could mean like being part of society. When they say Derech Eretz Kadma the Torah, which I think the earliest makor for that is a midrash called Pirkei Eliezer, when it appears in Pirkei Eliezer, Derech Eretz Kadma the Torah, what does it mean there? Do you know Derech Eretz Kadma the Torah? Masil Shashar makes a big deal about this. Derech Eretz Kadma the Torah. Again, he has Pirkei Eliezer. Don't you ever hear this before? Probably someone saying Derech Eretz Kadma the Torah. Why are you doing that?
Don't just be from to be from and be nice.
Be nice. Be a good person, right? Menschlichkeit. How can you be a Torah observant Jew? I can put on tefillin if you're not a mensch. Okay. But Rav Hirsch did not mean that. He might have accepted that, but he did not mean that. He says, someone want to volunteer to read it? I'm going to read some little beginning of it. I know you already read it, but we'll read some beginning of it a little bit. The term? Bakasha.
The term Derech Eretz includes all the situations arising from and dependent on the circumstance, and that the earth is a place where the individual must live, fulfill his destiny, and dwell together with others, and that he must utilize resources and conditions provided on earth in order to live in it and to accomplish his purpose.
So what does he mean by it? According to Derech Eretz, he primarily refer ways of
living.
So in other words, what does Hirsch mean by it? At least in this boiled down passage. Well, look at the line. It's coined a term Derech Eretz is used primarily to refer to ways of earning a living. In other words, a job. But there's something greater, grander than this. When the Reform movement came along, when modernity came along, I think it's Hegel says what defines modernity is the advent of the individual. Right? So when modernity came along, obviously individualism is something which doesn't totally jive with all kinds of aspects of any religious experience. You're part of a group. Right? Soloveitchik talks about that at great length, the Lone Man of Faith, right? You're part of a faith community that's going, as the Rav says, an existential angst, an ontic crisis, whatever those words mean, right? Antichrist, in the way you salvage your antichrist. You know what I'm talking about? Your absolute existential loneliness is by being in a group with other people who are existentially lonely, and therefore you pray together, which was very meaningful to me. That's my favorite passage of the Rav. But Rav Hirsch here says, you can work for a living. You can participate in society, right? When reform came along, when the walls of the ghetto started to crumble, England, interestingly enough, when they invited Jews back, there was no ghetto. England's kind of a funny aspect of European culture because, as opposed to originally Jews for a while were not in ghettos like in Spain, and then they moved into ghettos in Italy and other places. They started ghettoizing the Jew, and you have the Jewish streets in Germany where Jews weren't allowed to live. In England, when they eventually allowed the Jews back in the 17th century, right, Jews started living with non-Jews. That was one of the interesting experiments, is that Jews lived everywhere in England, which probably would not have happened hadn't they been kicked out 400 years earlier, right? But in any event, in Germany, he's arguing, okay, you can participate in society. Not everyone agreed. The Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, is labeled as kind of like the paradigms. Anyone know where the Chassam Sofer lived, Moshe Sofer lived?
Germany.
Well, it's interesting you say that. It's not what he's known to have lived, but you cheated. It's not fair to cheat. Everyone's like, you say death, but that was supposed to be the last one, right? And he said Germany, when that's supposed to be like the rabbit out of the hat. It's not fair. Moshe Sofer, he's primarily known for living in Budapest, right? Hungarian Jewry. Chassam Sofer's attitude was, look, we're confronted. He's well known for a statement. Anyone know that, if you would pick up one statement and say, oh, that's the Chassam Sofer. How many people have heard of the Chassam Sofer before?
Yeah.
Oh, Yofi, Hungarian Judaism. I once went to a conference on Hungarian Judaism at Harvard, and it was 8 hours of people reading academic papers at you. And then the last speaker was Elie Wiesel, who just told stories. It was a historian's conference. So what do you think the historians did? They started all growling. And I heard people were behind me like, how dare he speak in front of us? And who invited him? I'm like, oh my God, he's so good. Just listen to him. He was such a beautiful storyteller. He was like, you can't prove these stories are true, but just listening, they sound true. Who cares? You're so bored. He was great. But that was all the Hungarian Judaism. The Chassam Sofer is well known for a famous statement attributed to him. Anyone know what the statement is? Chadash asur min haTorah. That's what he's known. New things are asur min haTorah. Right? Now, they would have, can you guess what the first tshuva, this I did get from the Hungarian conference 25 years ago, the first tshuva where the Chassam Sofer used that phrase, which became the model for his anti-reform, that was on the banner of the anti-reform movement, was Chadash asur min haTorah. Those of you who heard me talk about Islam, when I was talking about the fact that in mosques they have a piece of the Quran which says God is one, not three, and you know who that's attacking, right? So Chassam Sofer, when he's Chashas Min HaTorah, he's attacking the Mitchadshim, right? The reform. But what's the first tshuva about? Yeah.
That tomatoes are not kosher.
No, although a lot of people thought tomatoes would kill you. There was an idea when the tomatoes were coming in, the people in Europe didn't eat tomatoes. In the New World, they had a lot of tomatoes, and they were afraid they were deadly. And they're blood fruit, and it's blood, and they eat blood, all this stuff. I like tomatoes. Don't get me wrong. But the first tshuva, the Chassam Sofer says, Chadash, Asur Min HaTorah, is on the topic of Chadash. Does anyone know what Chadash is? As opposed to Yashan? Yeah, what's Chadash was Yashan?
Wheat. You can't eat wheat that was grown in the same that year until after the Omer.
Right, so wheat that grows after Pesach, that starts growing after Pesach, you're not allowed to eat it until the second day of Pesach the following year. It started not growing, grows that whole year, you can do whatever, it's just to harvest it, and then after Pesach you can eat it. That's when you start bringing the Korban Omer, and we count the Omer to commemorate, or maybe whatever, I'll say commemorate to make it easy, commemorate the Korban Omer, which was brought on the second day of Pesach, and after you can start eating new wheat. So the question was, that halacha is what type of halacha? There's a term for those types of halachot. It's in Zrayim, but that particular type of thing, it's like Trumot, Ma'asrot, Achaia, Damai. What are they all connected to? The ground. They're all called mitzvot, ha? Tluyot, ba'aretz. Mitzvot connected to the land. It's machlokas, Rashi, Rabbeinu Chananel, if the land means ground or means Eretz Yisrael. But those only apply in Eretz Yisrael, with the exception of a couple. And one of those, a question about Chadash. Does Chadash apply outside of Eretz Yisrael? So the Chasam Sofer said, even in Chutz Laaretz, even here in Hungary, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, and that was just a quote of the Gemara. But then it became his banner. Anything new is Asur. Not do anything new, and what should we do? In fact, there's a wonderful Chasam Sofer, a really Zionist one. You know, many of his descendants moved to Israel, even though they would not have been part of the Zionist movement, but they're part of the Lovers of Israel movement. Chasam Sofer discusses, I think I discussed it with some people once, Chasam Sofer in two different places talks about the Gemara that I showed, that I have on here. In the Gemara over here, number one, I'm not going to go through the whole Gemara, but on the Gemara number one, it's talking about whether or not you should work and learn or just learn. And the conclusion is what?
Work.
You should do both. Right? Many people tried to just work and they failed. Others tried to work and learn and they found a life-learning balance. That's what the Gemara concludes. Chasam Sofer says that's the conclusion of the Gemara. So how could we in Hungary sit here and just learn and not work? So he says, so it must be that in Chutz Laaretz, where it's the land of the non-Jews, and therefore working is just for your parnassah, there's no mitzvah involved, and therefore Torah wins out. But in Eretz Yisrael, working the land itself is a mitzvah. So therefore, when you plant a garden in Eretz Yisrael, when you grow vegetables in Eretz Yisrael, when you build a apartment building in Eretz Yisrael, that's a key in the mitzvah of Kibush Aretz. You're fulfilling the mitzvah of living in Israel. And therefore, that outweighs Talmud Torah. Chasam Sofer in two different places says this. But in Chutz Aretz, what we need to do is we need to build walls. Everywhere we go, we build walls. We don't want to participate in what's going around us. And Hirsch, although he was part of his own movement, he broke off from Reform, and even broke off from the communal structures that were started being controlled by the Reform, said on the one hand, I don't have anything to do with the Reformers. They're wrong. Though he was good friends with some of the people in the Reform movement. He was very close in his early days with Abraham Geiger, who was one of the patriarchs of the Reform movement. And they have a lot of letters back and forth, etc. Then they had a split. But Hirsch looked at the world and said, listen, Jews can participate in the world. I don't agree with Chasam Sofer. Basically, we're given a possible binary option. Participate in the world, run away from the world. Chasam Sofer said, build walls. In fact, it's a very poignant one. Chasam Sofer said, we're in a war. Our war is with modernity. Our war is with the modernizers of Judaism. And in every war, there are casualties. And therefore, if we have to build big walls, if we have to be super stringent in the way we keep halakha, we'll do that. And if it means some people will stop being religious, that's their problem. Right? All we have to do is build the walls high. That wasn't accepted by many people within what we call today Haredi Judaism. It wouldn't be fair to call him Haredi because it was before that really came, but he's kind of one of the progenitors. You see this in Mithaliyahu, Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler says the exact same thing and is criticized by it by the Sriya Eish, a rabbi who was originally Eastern European then moved to Germany. And he critiques that idea, not Rav Dessler, because Rav Dessler's afterwards, but he critiques that idea. And I remember I found it in Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler says, the goal of Judaism post-Shoah, he's writing post-Shoah in England, post-Shoah is to be as strict as possible, because we are elitists. And the goal is to be as strict as possible and not try and build bridges. Hirsch said, no, you can be part of the world. In fact, he says right here, be part of the world. Yeah? And live in part of the world. In fact, in Hirsch built a school, and in that school they had secular studies. So Chasam Sofer outlawed. Other things Chasam Sofer outlawed is said, listen, you can't give public lectures in anything but Yiddish. And if Hirsch spoke in German, you can't incorporate German commentaries or any other language commentaries. But you're right, because he's some sort of from Germany, but he fled. When he was 18, he fled from Hungary, so he wanted to flee the Reform. You can't have vernacular commentaries in your Chumash, totally prohibited. You can't have weddings inside, totally prohibited. Anything that looks like what the Reformers are doing to copy what he saw as copying the non-Jews will build walls, and that will be the end of it. And Hirsch said, no, let's not do that. Anyone ever read the B'nai Akiva Tshuva by the Sridi Eish? It's always referred to B'nai Akiva Tshuva by the Sridi Eish. The Sridi Eish was Rav Yaakov Weinberg. Rav Yaakov Weinberg lived through the Shoah. He actually survived the Shoah. It's a wonderful book by Mark Shapiro on him. He survived the Shoah. He was in a Russian work camp. He didn't even know. It's really horrendous. He didn't know what was going on. They arrested him early on in Germany, sent him to a Russian prison. He was there for 5 years. He got out at the end of the war, and he was going to go back to Frankfurt to Berlin to get his library because he thought all his stuff was still there. He had no idea, he had no idea that everyone was dead, right, or left, or whatever. He was, totally devastated. After the war, the Sridi Eish was approached by Jews in France, who said, here we are in France, and we have co-ed youth groups. Anyone heard of the co-ed youth group thing? We have co-ed youth groups, we have co-ed singing, girls and boys sing Shabbos and we wrote together, co-ed schools. Is this a problem? All these rabbis, this is 1950s after the Shoah, and people are trying to pick everything up, right? All these rabbis are coming and telling us we're wrong to do it. So Sridi A says a number of things that are fascinating. He was not into it. He said you shouldn't have co-ed schools. But I know one thing. I know one thing is when I first came to Germany, I was shocked that women sang with the men and they had co-ed singing and all this co-ed stuff. I was shocked, but I discovered something. He says in Eastern Europe, they raised a generation of Jews who were fervently religious, and if you weren't, you were gone. In Germany, they raised a generation of Jews, and this is based on Rav Hirsch, that's what he says, based on Hirsch's philosophy, that allowed you to be both actively, seriously engaged in Judaism and seriously engaged in the world at the same time. And it worked, just like the Gemara says. He says, our method worked. They destroyed a whole generation of Jews in Eastern Europe who just lost Judaism. And we learned how to find a balance between working for a living, being engaged in the world, and whatnot. And that was the model of Hirsch as understood by the Sridi Eish. Let's go on. The next part. Next part is Zionism. More radical than Rav Hirsch, because we saw Gemara about it, is the idea of a Jewish state. The idea of a Jewish state is actually not so simple. Now, what we do know, it strikes me as funny because I often read certain people who are very left-wing in Zionist issues, especially in America, and the certain rabbis like to say how un-Jewish the Jewish state is because of whatever reason. So what always kind of strikes me as funny is how can you say that you want all the land? How can you say that you want things like that? We'll open up the text for a second. And while the idea of a political entity, if you want to choose a political entity, where's the first text you might look at to understand what a political entity in the land of Israel would look like? So you could look back to the Bible, Tanakh, for sure. What's the easiest? That's not where I would look. But maybe that's just me. That's just because, I've been biased by Brisker Torah. Where's the first place you would look? Or I would look. If you're guessing, if you were me and not you, where you want to look for a real explanation of what a Jewish government should look like? We don't have much stuff. Rambam, way before Herzl. Rambam. Herzl wasn't so interested in a traditional Jewish government. That's my point. Rambam. And Rambam describes what he thinks the third Beit HaMikdash should be like, and what the world of Jews should be like, and what should it be? A monarchy. The reinstitution of a Jewish monarchy. That's authentic Judaism. So the idea of a Jewish state was not so simple. Many, many, many rabbis in Europe rejected it outright. Right? They rejected Zionism because the idea of coming back now, forcing the hand of Mashiach, was unacceptable. They were against it because the people who were most actively for creating a Jewish state were secularists who didn't keep kosher, who were trying to reinvent Judaism and destroy what they had in Europe. For a number of reasons, but the ideas itself, we know the ideas of coming back to Eretz Yisrael, we daven for it three times a day. Right? We say, God, please bring us back. But we don't say there, though. We don't say the Shemoneh Esrei, create a democratic state. Right? That was a novelty. Herzl is a novelty. Now, if you read Herzl, by the way, and this is not a course in Zionism, read Herzl, and one of the best thing, if you want to read the original, Herzl wrote a letter to the Jewish Chronicle in London when he was setting out to write his book, his pamphlet on the Jewish state, and it is a synopsis of his view of what the Jewish state should be. That appears in, there's a wonderful reader called The Jew in the Modern World, so they have the Jewish Chronicle there if you want to know access to it. What was his reason? What was his reason? Herzl's reason for creating Jewish state? What?
Escape persecution.
Escape, primarily escape persecution. The Jew is an alien in Europe. We tried it. We tried, you know, we tried this, we tried that, and all of a sudden we see pogroms and we see attacks on Jews who were in the French military, and we see this. Jews are just alien. And if we can only put them together in a country and be part of kind of the modern future of statehood, like all these nations were, then they can become like washed and cleaned and part of the world. Let's leave Rav Kook for a second. You guys have it in English. Can I read it in Hebrew, though? Rav Kook would have never wanted you to read it in English, but I gave the English. I should have photocopied the Hebrew for you as well. I feel bad I should have done that. But just listen, you can read the English, but I'm just going to read the Hebrew in trans as we go. Eretz Yisrael einena davar chitzoni. You guys have the translation. What does he first say? Eretz Yisrael is not... What? Is that what it says there? Peripheral matter?
Yeah.
Ugh, that's awful. That's not a good translation. I mean, I took it from like some internet translation. I'll translate. Ignore that. Eretz Yisrael einena davar chitzoni. Chitzoni is what? Chutz? Outside. It's not outside the Jew. It's not just like a piece of land, right? There's humans, there's land, we'll put them together. We have a country. That's not what it is. Kinyan chitzoni luma, a external acquisition by a nation. Right? The United States of America, as opposed to many other countries, I read a fascinating book. It's a fascinating book called like, Telling the Truth of History. It's written by three historians. I assume they're American historians. I mean, they're Americans. I assume they're American history historians. And one of the things they talk about at length is how America was invented by Thomas Jefferson. But Thomas Jefferson created an ideology of what America is because your 13 colonies really had not that much to do with each other. A bunch of immigrants, they didn't all necessarily get along, didn't necessarily all have the same vision. They had one thing in common. What was the one thing in common in 1776?
British rule.
Knocking the Brits out. That's it. And when the war was over, what did they agree about? So Thomas Jefferson was brilliant and created a philosophy of what it means to be American so the colonies could say, oh, we're all one thing. It was not so simple. And then people from where I grew up decided to try and leave, and it didn't work. But that's for another story. It doesn't go well in my house because my wife is from New Jersey, and we talk about the South rising again. It just doesn't happen. Okay. Rock Victor Emsa Eva Matara Shel Hahit Agduta Kalit. It's not just a medium whose goal is to unify, a general unification of the people, v'chazakak huma chomrita, or to enable it to live a physical existence or even a spiritual existence. It's not a tool. Herzl saw it as a tool. I'm not saying Rav Kook was addressing Herzl per se, but he's certainly addressing the idea. It's not a tool. Eretz Yisrael hi chativa asmutit shura bekesher chayim im ha'uma. Eretz Yisrael is a unit, independent unit connected with the bonds of life with the nation. So
Rav Kook's idea was we were always supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. The Jew outside of Eretz Yisrael is alien. Why? Because it's an alien world. You're not where you're supposed to be. That's not what you were born to be. That dirt is not your lifeblood. He has underpinnings behind it, but that notion that Eretz Yisrael and that therefore maybe not Yisrael has some significance. Now, he obviously died before the advent of the country and has its precedence if you look in the Gemara in Ketubot, the Tosef that's quoting the Gemara in Ketubot about the power of Eretz Yisrael, that someone who lives, the Tosef that says, Hadar chutz le'Eretz Yisrael kimi she'ein lo Elohah. It's like someone who has no God. That's what Tosef says. And then the Gemara says, is it really true? You have no God if you live outside of Eretz Yisrael? No, it's as if you have no God. As if you're worshiping idols. That's pretty harsh. That's the Gemara. That's Tosefta. Right? The rabbis of the Mishnah. So they're saying, if you live outside of Eretz Yisrael, you are alienated. That's echoed on and on. It's echoed in the Kuzari. If you guys have read the Kuzari, especially the last section of the Kuzari, he says that the divine presence is still there. And if you're living outside, you're disconnected from the gates of heaven. It's only the Jew who lives in Israel is connected to the gates of heaven. It's echoed by the Ramban 100 years later, who says that keeping mitzvot outside of Eretz Yisrael is only for practice. But really the only impact of keeping mitzvot is in Eretz Yisrael. There's certainly a huge trajectory. Again, it's not electron Zionism. There's what to push back. But I'm saying Rav Kook was more or less adopted from very early time by those people who we'll call, for lack of a better term, modern Orthodox outside of Israel. I don't think it applies in Israel so much. I have 10 more minutes. Now we can use Rabbi Soloveitchik in 10 minutes. So is it okay to use Rav Hirsch's idea of being integrated into the world? By the way, the dichotomies we're going to make are not so simple. For his 100th birthday, I believe it was his birthday, Rav Hirsch had a Shabbaton in his synagogue for Schiller. He also, Rav Hirsch did all kinds of radical things. He wore rabbinical robes, which is something that the Reform did. He copied the Reform in this, and many people are super against it, but he tried to be more like the world around you. You can enjoy the arts. You can participate in literature, right? You can appreciate all the wonderful things. You can read secular literature, and you can read the Bible, etc. That's how I was going to speak, reach a crescendo when we deal with aspects of Rabbi Soloveitchik. This piece of Rabbi Soloveitchik, why'd I get in trouble for it? We're marching in time, right? Because we're going to late 19th century, beginning of 20th century, and now we're already getting to the middle of the 20th century, right? Why did I get in trouble for it?
Because he says it's good to accept the modern world. Whereas Torah didn't want to live in the modern world.
Even more than that. You want to read it? Read it. The brute.
The brute's existence is an undignified one because it is a helpless existence. Human existence is a dignified one because it is glorious. It is a glorious, majestic, powerful existence. Hence, dignity is unattainable, as long as man has not reclaimed himself from coexistence with nature, and has not risen from a non-reflective, degradingly helpless, instinctive life to an intelligent, planned, and majestic one. Man of old, who could not fight disease, and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever, or any other plague with degrading helplessness, could not lay claim to dignity.
That's the line. That's the line. The one who builds hospitals, the one who tries to cure disease, that's dignity. Well, let me ask you a question. Okay, I know there's a thing about the Chazon Ish. There's a story. I don't know if you know who the Chazon Ish was. Chazon Ish is considered by some as the creator of Haredi Judaism in Israel. We have his books on the shelf. He's a huge posek came to Eretz Yisrael in the 30s, died in the late 50s from Vilna. The Chazon Ish supposedly really liked reading medical books, and they say about him that there was one time that someone needed brain surgery, and the doctor said he couldn't do it, and the Chazon Ish, he said, bring me the x-rays, looked at the x-rays, he said, no, they're doing it wrong. I don't know. There's such a story. I'm kind of skeptical of those stories. I mean, if I had a choice of a rabbi, I mean, I like rabbis, right? I am one, right? I like them. I have a lot of rabbis I have tremendous respect for. And I'll tell you an interesting medical thing in a second, but I got to tell you, if I have a choice of a rabbi doing brain surgery on me, or my kid, or, you know, a surgeon, who am I going to choose? I'm going to choose a surgeon. right? I'm not church of surgery who was trained in medical school. So when the Rav is saying this, what is he advocating for?
People being doctors.
People being doctors, right? And who are those doctors? In order to become a doctor, what do you have to study besides anatomy? You got to study the overarching thing, medicine, the overarching science, mathematics. If you don't study those things as culture, as humans don't, you live an undignified existence. Maybe not everyone has to be a doctor. We need rabbis who study to be rabbis. We need doctors who study to be doctors. Right? They're different people. But the notion of Jews embracing the sciences for him was critical. Rav Lichtenstein supposedly asked the Rav, he said he wanted to do a PhD in something which would be enlightening, which would lead him to spirituality. You know what the Rav said? He should study. So Lichtenstein wanted to do a doctorate. I'm going to do a doctorate, and I want, he goes to his father-in-law, I want to study something that will lead me to deeper spiritual understanding. So you know what the Rav said? Yes.
The need to English literature.
Yes, but that's not what the Rav told him.
Doctor?
No. Math. Oh, you really want spirituality? Study math. Right? It was Plato, actually. Plato, I think, it said that math was a gift of the gods. Right? You ever heard, like, you know, some mathematicians will say a formula is beautiful. It's spiritual. You can look at something that explains all this. The Rav was very into mathematics and mathematical sciences, and I was a huge fan of that. And Rav Lichtenstein supposedly started that path. And then decided it was not for him and switched to English literature. But this idea that the human being should be engrossed in all kinds of things, right? Because that's dignity. And who told us to live a dignified existence? God. Right? So what we walk away with is kind of this idea, and Lichtenstein didn't love it in his essay, but I do understand these end up being kind of like a notion of Judaism, integration in the world and not rejection of the world, integration, looking at the future and embracing the Jews' return to Eretz Yisrael and kind of being on the map the world of Tanakh, and being embracing the advent of human culture, especially the sciences and mathematics and those things which build us. And by the way, just as for fun, one of the things, I started out with a quote of this study that wanted to suggest that 65% of modern Orthodox Jews think that modern Orthodoxy as an approach to Judaism is authentic. But I just want to read you something. Listen to this. Okay? As authentic Judaism. The following is a curriculum that they found from a school, a Jewish school in Spain in 1180. So this is the curriculum in 1180 for Jewish schools. Reading and writing. The method of instruction must be so arranged the teacher will begin a script, blah, blah, teaching kids how to write. Then Torah, Mishnah, and Hebrew grammar. Unlike many Ashkenazim, Sephardim were always grammarians, are always very into grammar and pronouncing things correctly. They go on to say it's very important the teacher teaches kids how to pronounce things correctly. The teacher is to continue this until age of 10 years of age, learning Mishnah up to 10, based on Pirkei Avot, 5 years, learn Mishnah, etc. Then poetry. The teacher is instructed pupils in poetry, should for the most part have them recite religious poems, and whatever else the beauty is found in different types of poetry. In other words, learn literature, right? Talmud, next up, 15 Talmud. Then, you ready? Philosophic observations on religion. Next, philosophic studies, philosophy. Logic, mathematics and arithmetic. Optics, astronomy, music, mechanics, natural sciences and medicine, and then ultimately metaphysics. This is following the classic medieval curriculum. But the idea that an integration, you know, the most radical piece we've said here is Zionism, is Eretz Yisrael, but the other pieces totally stem from the past. So I think looking at the three of them as pillars, certainly we have a strong connection to Eretz Yisrael as well, but looking at the three of them as pillars, this idea of being integrated into the world, the idea of a connection to the Jew being part of nationalism and rebuilding Midianite Israel and the State of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, and certainly being engrossed in not just in Torah, but in the whole world of intellectual pursuit, seems not only to be authentic, but seems to be certainly the classic perspective on a good chunk of Judaism, all the way from the Gemara through the Rishonim, certainly in those areas until today. And that's all the time I have. Thank you for listening. Yeah.